Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Every stranger you pass on the street has a story. But how much can we really know about them? How much can we really know about people with whom we have a more intimate familiarity? Friends or colleagues, say, thrown together for a dinner party. In a way, they too are strangers with stories.
As the traffic of conversation got moving again, something about the governor and healthcare, I thought about what else I could have said to the now less endearing Napoleonic former interim chair.
This is Wayland writer Rita Zoe Chen, recounting just such a dinner party with her husband's co-workers from Boston Medical Center.
I could have told him that by the time I was six, I'd known violence the way some kids know bedtime stories. I could have told him that the first number I ever dialed was 911 during what would be one of many vicious fights between my parents. That to save myself, I started running away when I was 11 and then spent years living between state-run institutions and the streets, where I wandered around looking for a safe place to call home, but instead ended up sleeping in staircases or empty cars or, more often, the questionable beds of men and women. I could have told him that I'd been a stripper, a junkie, the kind of girl who would never be welcome in an elite place like this. I might have also mentioned that I'd put myself through college and grad school, summa cum laude, that I taught college students how to write, and that I did these things after dropping out of junior high in the eighth grade. I could have said that in my short life, I had teetered at the abyss of death more than once. But a charming doctor's wife wouldn't tell him any of that.
Now, at that particular dinner party, Rita was just one of those people you meet, raise a glass with, and make small talk. But in her case, each one of those heartbreaking, harrowing stories, well, they're all true. Rita Zoe Chin, that charming doctor's wife, as she calls herself, has finally told her story in the new memoir, Let the Tornado Come.
Rita visited our studios earlier today, and just a warning here, this conversation may not be appropriate for all of our listeners, because Rita talks frankly about the violence and abuse she experienced as a young girl. Abuse that began right at home, she says, at the hands of both her mother and father.
Yeah, sadly, it was a grim upbringing. My father was more physically violent than my mother. My mother was more kind of like slap you around, pull you around by your hair kind of thing. But my father, you know, he used things like belts and fists and legs, like kicking and things like that. So sadly, it was a rough time.
Yeah. I mean, this is all before you're 10, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I mean, your writing is so clear and controlled now. I mean, were you at that time, even when you were little, were you sort of looking to writing to help? The process is not the right word, because how does like a 7-year-old process these things? But I mean, were you writing at that time too?
Yeah, I was writing, but never about that. What I was doing was using my imagination to write stories that were very different from the story I was living every day. And so I actually escaped through writing until I could physically escape.
Yeah. I mean, how and when and what you wrote is something I want to talk to you about a little more in a bit, but you do end up running away from home. But that sort of was triggered by some stuff which I have to say I just found to be really hard to read. Not because it was badly written, but it was just like emotionally very difficult to read. Your parents get divorced and your father was on his way to... He remarried?
He did. He remarried.
So he essentially, your father essentially made you all these promises about undoing his past behavior. You had to talk to a judge and say you wanted to live with your father, and essentially you're testifying against your mother?
I testified against my mother. Yes, I did.
Before you go and give that testimony, were you even writing at that time? Like, were you writing poems? I can't remember.
I was.
In the courthouse?
Yes. I wasn't allowed in the courtroom during their hearing, so I sat out on a bench in the hallway and wrote poems in a notebook, and there were little windows and I could see the sky, and so I was writing about the birds that would like occasionally fly past and kind of whatever occupied my curiosity or imagination in the moment.
When I read that, I just thought the resilience of children, but I also thought, was that your way of coping? I mean, was that your way of fighting off the kind of anxiety that would beset you later in life?
I think so. I think it's kind of like Harold and the Purple Crayon. Like, you know, you just you draw your way out.
So then I was going to say your life takes a turn, but like it seems like every step of your life is one turn after another into these unknown directions. But you run away several times.
Many times,
many
yes.
times. And things just get tougher for you.
Yeah, they do in a sense. Although I will say this, you know, I was on the streets pretty much from age 13 to almost 16. But the difference was that at least when I was running, there was hope. At home, there was no hope. I knew that things weren't going to change, and I lived in fear every day. And even though, yeah, being a runaway and living on the streets was very traumatic in many ways, I still got to wake up every day thinking maybe tomorrow will be different or maybe today will be different. And so I got to hold on to hope.
Rita, forgive me for pressing you on this, because I know an interview is a different thing than sort of the solitary act of writing a book and writing a memoir and trying to figure out how to share your story. But I get what you're saying about the feeling of empowerment. But at the same time, you know, this period of your life, I mean, you're what, a preteen? You have to have sex for money. You get kidnapped by a couple who pimp you out, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's a dark time.
Yes, that in particular was the darkest.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened to you?
Sure. I, you know, part of how I survived, you know, as a runaway is I stayed with different people that I met, random strangers. And I was staying with somebody who was actually kind of nice. And unfortunately, at a nightclub, he got stabbed. And so I was staying in his apartment by myself. And I got lonely. And one of his friends came and said, hey, you want to take a ride to D.C.? And I was like, okay, what else am I doing? And as we were driving, it was raining. And I remember we stopped at a red light, and I had this urge, this like inexplicable urge to get out of the car and run. And I actually had my hand on the door handle, and then the light turned. And I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. You're going to get out and run in the middle of the street in the rain? So we went down and went to a strip club and met this woman there. And I quickly realized, you know, that what was going on wasn't that we were going to get pot. It was that they were going to try to, you know, as you said, pimp me out. And he beat me pretty badly and told me that if I ever tried to escape again, he would kill me and throw me in a dumpster. So they took me to Virginia Beach, actually, to some like kind of squalid motel there, and brought a guy from the naval base back. And that was, you know, being kidnapped was horrible, but that moment was, I guess, also horrible because I expected more out of humanity. And here I am, this, you know, young teenager who's like black and blue, and this man comes in and like looks right past that, you know, because he's just focused on his own desire. And
how old were you again?
I was 14. So
I don't even know what to say, actually.
I'm looking at you right now.
I mean, it's I don't even know what to say, that people do that to other people. It's really disturbing.
It's funny, writing the book from this perspective now, I still see it as hopeful, which I know this part of the conversation right now sounds pretty grim, but, you know, we survive things, and we don't have to be as damaged as we sometimes think that, you know, based on what we've been through, that we might be. Like, we can rise up. I think that's what I've learned anyway.
But I wanted to ask you again, like, how writing mattered to you during this dark part of your life? Because was this the time at which there were times where you didn't even have a piece of paper even to write on, so you'd write on the insides of your arms?
Yeah, I still do that.
You still do?
If I don't have a piece of paper handy. I know, it's not a good habit. Yeah, but I did. I think that it was the thing that always brought me back to myself, you know, and it was one small, whether it's like just the area on the inside of my arm or the sole of my shoe or a little piece of grocery bag that I ripped off, it was an area that I could control. And
do you remember the kinds of things that you would write on the inside of your arm?
I was always looking at whatever was going on in the sky. I wrote about the stars a lot. I think I was looking up and out, you know, away. And which is no surprise that I fell in love with the poet Mary Oliver when I discovered her in my late teens.
Mary Oliver, she wrote that poem about there's a line in it about, what are you going to do with your one wild and precious life?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Yeah, that's it. That's the I love that you just remember that. That's the essence of Yeah. So basically, there's nothing more I ever need to say because she said it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I asked you about the writing on the, literally writing with a pen on the skin inside of your arm, because there just seems to be something so tragically tenacious about it, right? That even if you basically had nothing, you didn't even have a piece of paper, but yet you still found like this ability to say, I'm here, here's what I'm thinking, despite of what I'm experiencing. And you left evidence of it, you know, on your own skin. The last thing that you had, you still maintained some sort of ownership of, even though you, in a sense, you didn't really, your own body.
Yeah, you know, and occasionally I wrote notes to myself too. And it's kind of corny now when I think about it, but, you know, just trying to sort of root for myself or be like, hey, I got your back, I'm right here. So that I could look down and, you know, there would be something there.
So let's get to one of the places where hope really does shine through, because you've gone through this very difficult childhood. You never graduated from high school.
I never went to high school.
You never even went to high school.
No, yeah.
Right. And you were sort of in and out of detention centers, jail, drugs, et cetera. I mean, the whole thing, really. But there's a point at which you just said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. You ended up getting a GED.
I did.
Also,
yes.
And going to Towson in Maryland.
I did. Yeah. It was the only college I applied to. And I just wrote a letter and said, I've had a really rough life, but I'd really love to go to college here.
Did it feel strange, though? Because I can imagine that you know, you're walking around amongst your fellow students thinking, none of you have any clue where I have been.
You know, I have thought that many times, but in that moment I didn't, because, you know, there's the saying attributed to the Buddha, how sweetly the lotus grows in the litter of the wayside. And this idea that this lotus flower can come through like the murkiest, dirtiest water and come up clean. And that day I didn't feel bogged down by any of my past at all. Just walking across the campus, I let myself, and maybe that's the writer in me, or that, like, you know, I let myself fully inhabit that role as a student who was getting to have a normal life.
So later on, when you're in grad school, you met the man who became your husband.
Yeah. We moved to Boston. He got a job as chairman at BMC here, the neurosurgery department. And we moved to basically my dream house, you know, the life that as a runaway I had been like hoping for, peering into other people's windows, and like here it was, like, you know, I was getting to have it. So
forgive me for saying this, but this is, I mean, for people who've been keeping track of your journey,
yes,
as we've been discussing it, this is incredible, right? I mean, you come from having two parents who were both very abusive to you, to being a runaway, to being kidnapped and abused all over again, drugs, alcohol, juvenile detention, and now you find yourself in Boston married to the neurosurgery chairman at Boston Medical Center, living a, you know, like a picture book life.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Kind of unexpected. It was amazing. I thought it never took a single minute for granted. And you know, it was moving here too. It was, you know, we lived in this quaint little town, Wayland, which is, you know, if you've been there, you know, it's just a small town. We live across the street from cows, you know, and it was the most beautiful, most peaceful place I'd ever lived.
But it's at this point in your life that these really horrible anxiety attacks set in.
Yeah. So a few months after we moved here, I was sitting at my computer kind of mindlessly, you know, surfing the interwebs or whatever I was doing. I don't even remember exactly, but I had this strange feeling and my heart started pounding and I thought I was having a heart attack. So I called 911 and it was a beautiful morning and I thought, you know, I'm going to die. I'm about to die. That's what it felt like. And it turned out, like you said, it was a panic attack. And, you know, the only thing I can think is that it's kind of like when you go on vacation and you finally relax and then you get sick. It was like I finally let my guard down. We moved to a beautiful place. I had, you know, miles between my family and me. Like everything was calm and I'd always been in motion and like suddenly I'd stopped and then there I was. You know, if I wasn't running physically, then my body was going to go into fight flight all by itself. And that's kind of what happened.
Well, what did you find out about the nature of why you were having them?
What a therapist told me, who has actually helped me quite a bit, is that I was in basically PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, I thought that I had escaped my childhood and I was living this happy life. But as it turned out, there was still some work to do and I had to sort of travel back. And deal with some of the trauma of
my
young
life. You write about it in the book, that basically no matter how far we come, there's always a part of us that's touching our past.
Exactly. Which is, I think, why the moving back and forth in time the way I do in the book seems really natural, is because part of us is in the past, part of us is looking toward the future, and then, you know, there's this other part of us that's here now. And, you know, the saying, be here now, and we are as much as we can, but I think it's inescapable, like you said, you know, that there's always some part touching, and there was a lot of part touching at that time, so...
Rita, I'm curious. We've talked about so much, so many experiences in your life. What does it feel like to you to be so honest and share all these things, both bad and good, that have happened to you?
Well, you know, it feels actually good, because last week I went back to one of the adolescent places where I was, and I talked to the kids there, and my main message to them was, you know, you don't have to let your past define who you are. And so I feel like that's kind of what my book is saying.
Yeah. Also, I'm just curious. The title of the memoir is Let the Tornado Come. Why did you title that?
Well, I think it's obvious that it's a metaphor, but also there is a tornado, but I won't give it away. ultimately, things are going to happen to us, wonderful, amazing things and bad things and scary things. And it's an illusion to think that we can control any of it. So there's a kind of freedom in just like opening your arms to the sky and saying, okay, let it come. Like, yeah, what can I do? I'm just going to go with it, because I can't control it. I can't fight it.
I'm so amazed by your attitude. It's marvelous, really.
Thank you. So you're going to make me blush.
Well, this is radio, so no one's going to see you blush. Well, Rita Zoe Chin's new memoir is titled Let the Tornado Come. Rita, thank you so much for, first of all, writing the book, and then for coming on the program and sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much for having me. It's really been just a joy to be here.
Wow. Quite a story here on Radio Boston. Our program is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
The show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Alex Kingsbury, Emmajean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, and Jamie Bologna, with help from Virginia Marshall and Sarah Herman.
Tim Skog is our technical director.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.